I got a smattering of rain, yes.
Okay, I'm going to say I was lucky because I was at my outdoor workout at Selkirk Elementary, and like it started raining right on us while we were working out, and it felt so good.
I bet. Like,
the best experience of being rained on.
I got it's... nothing. There's no. nothing here. Not a drop.
It's so funny because you know that the heat has been so long and so severe that Vancouverites are excited about the rain.
Yeah.
Like, that's very unusual for this city. Yeah. Record shattering, 41 days, I think. We probably went like 42, 43 in the end. But
yeah.
Someone posted a list of like the years where we've broken heat records in BC. And it's like every year except last year, we have broken the previous record.
Fun. Great. I love it. Today, I went out with my PM 2.5 mask that I bought specifically for smoke season because the smoke finally was blown back to us. And I put a COVID mask over it because it has a vent. And I'm like, this is great. This is so apocalyptic. I love it. We're all having an awesome time here. It's fantastic.
The very first comic I ever published with Cloudscape was a 2-page story set in the distant future of 2050 in Vancouver. And everyone wore masks and like had gloves so they wouldn't like have to touch each other. And coffee was illegal. And there was a war in the Arctic. And I'm worried now that too much of that is going to be true by the time we get to 2050.
Oh dear, 2050 might be distant.
I think getting to 2050 is pretty ambitious, John.
Well, speaking of,
we don't need to worry about that. Let's go back to the halcyon days of 1990.
Actually, I also had the idea in my head that Death Note was from the 90s. It's not from the 90s.
Oh, that's right.
It's from 2003 is when it started.
It's so funny that we'll get into it, but there's a joke in the kind of side matter about Hyokuroli getting excited about the release of the Game Boy Advance SP.
Yeah.
And I have a Game Boy Advance SP in silver. And I was like, oh, cool. I got the thing that Hyok wanted. I've been playing it recently. I've been playing Pokemon Pinball, so...
Okay, well, so I think we've given away what we're reading here. We are reading Death Note. This is volumes 1 and 2. We are going to do another episode with volumes 3 and 4 at some point. So hopefully no spoilers this episode for 3 and 4 or the rest of the series, but expect to be spoiled for the first 2 volumes. And so let's start with a character building question. My first idea, of course, was just to ask you, like, who would you kill with the Death Note?
Harsh.
And I decided, no, I'm not sure that we want to go down that road. That might be legally actionable. So instead, I'm going to ask you, what is an item of stationery, either that you own now or have owned in the past, that is very important to you?
Oh my god, this is my wheelhouse now. I'm actually going to have to think. Because there's so much stationery that I love. I'm a stationery nerd.
I mean, I guess I'll go first then. I'm Jeff Ellis, and I mean, I hope this counts, but I would just say, like, the, like, standard issue Moleskin notebook with the, like, elastic band... cover strap and the little pocket in the back, preferably blank page. That is like my number one like pocket sketchbook, which I was recently realizing that throughout all of 2020, I did not use a Moleskin because I was at home all the time and I only used Moleskins to go to a bar and do some sketching or like go somewhere and sketch and there was nowhere to go. So I'm kind of thinking I need to restock my Moleskin collection and get back into it. But yeah, that's my go-to stationery.
You're making me want to shout out my favorite logbook. which is the Muji A6, I think, grid note, which is what I use for all my engineering work. It's a beautiful notebook, and I don't think I can go back. But my favorite piece of stationery is, I'm actually going to go a little bit left field with this and shout out some washi tape. So washi tape, for those who aren't obsessed with stationery like I am, is a special kind of paper-like masking tape that's originally came from Japan, but is now very common in a lot of Southeast Asian countries. You can get them from Korea, you can get them from China, and it has now become one of the popular items that creators in the webcomic world will make. So I've got a few special washi tapes that I absolutely love. I've got one that I picked up from Koyamori that has just these little cats in a little like forest world. And it's like a little scene on the tape, and you can put it on the edges of paper to decorate like the tops and bottoms of your pages. It's really beautiful. And like every washi tape that I have has like a little memory attached of like when I got this washi tape. And so it's very silly, but it's a nice way to bring a little bit more sentimentality and beauty to whatever you're doing.
I can see I picked the right question here.
Yeah.
You struck a nerve with me for sure, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I could talk for hours about stationery.
Welcome to the Trade Waiters, a podcast about stationery.
Don't tempt me. Don't tempt me, Jonathan.
That's our next podcast.
Okay. So I think I'm going to call out my pencil of choice. It's just a mechanical pencil, but this is the only kind of mechanical pencil I will buy now. It's a Sakura Sumo Grip. And what's special about it is that it's really thick. So it's got a soft grip. So it's like a lot easier on my fingers if I'm going to be drawing for hours and hours. Any mechanical pencil I've ever used that has like doesn't have a soft grip or is like really skinny, so it's like, no, this is not good for my hands. So it's got to be this one specifically. And there was a time when I had just one, and then event like nothing lasts forever, so it would like fall apart, and then I would be unable to draw until I bought a new one. So since then, I now have two. I have my main one, and then I have a backup for so that the instant that this one kicks the bucket, that I've got a new one waiting in the wings.
It's always such a nice feeling when you land on a piece of kit that really works for you. And I think that's a very cartoonist thing, right? Where, oh, I found this thing that I really, really like. I better buy 20 of it because they're going to change the formula or they're going to like discontinue it. That actually happened to one of my pens. And I had to get quantity 20 from like JetPens to... They stopped carrying it at Daiso, and I nearly lost my mind.
I mean, that is, like, there's, like, a legendary story about Charles Schulz, that he had a particular, like, dip pen nib that he liked to use, and the company went out of business, so he bought all the remaining stock, because he's Charles Schulz, and so he had a lifetime supply of this nib until he died, because he was able to just buy up all the remaining stock from the company.
Yeah. The struggle is real. Like, even if they don't go out of business, like at one point, my Canson watercolor paper that I like changed their tooth slightly.
Oh, no.
I was so pissed.
Yeah, this happens to me because I use markers for coloring. And like, I have like three different brands of markers that I use just because I'm worried that someday one of these brands will cease to exist, and then I don't want to have to reinvent all of my colors at once. But there was one brand of markers that I was like one of my staples, and they redesigned the marker, like physically redesigned it, and the new markers would dry out really quickly. And they were more expensive, and it was just garbage. So I had to like find new colors to replace all those colors, and then they stopped making them because apparently everyone had figured out that these markers were garbage. But by that point, it was like, oh, it's too late. All my markers, all my good markers are gone. I have to like get these other brands.
Oh, so, no.
I live in constant fear of that happening again.
Oh, man.
Natural media struggles.
Marker creators take note.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah, that's part of why there's not very many marker creators.
Yeah, after 10 years of it, I was lucky that every single piece was standalone. Because, yeah, like if you run out of the color for like the color of my hair in the comic, like I would run out of that. And then having to use like a slightly different color just looked totally weird and wrong.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about Death Note. So a little bit about the creators first. This is not the Trade Reader's first trip with Tsugumi Oba and Takeshi Obata. We also did two episodes on Bakuman, which was their follow-up to Death Note.
And I was reading in this book that the artist was, remind me, what was their big comic? It was the one with Go, Hikaru no Go.
That's right.
Yeah, it's very different.
Yeah,
but that also a very good comic.
That one has a different writer. It's written by Yumi Hota. So Takeshi Obata had worked in several comics before. The one other than Bakuman and Death Note that's most well-known is Hikaru no Go, which is, I believe, about people playing Go.
Yes, that's correct.
I read one chapter of it, and I was like, this is just a bunch of people thinking about what their next Go movie is going to be.
Highly recommend the anime. It's like sports anime. It's really fun.
If you're interested in getting better at the game of Go, it's a good manga.
That's actually a really good selling point, because I did teach myself how to play it once, but knowing the rules doesn't tell you how to end a game, because it's like chess where you just have to know there are no more useful moves I can make. And like, I don't understand the game well enough to be able to know when I'm at that point.
Right. Well, if you finished all of Hikaru no Go, you would then understand.
Okay.
I think you're glossing over the most important thing, which is it's a teenage Go player who he gets the spirit of a Go master who only he can see, who like helps him on his quest.
Yeah, he's coached by a ghost.
Okay.
It's fun. It's a fun series. I can understand why the manga would be kind of slow, but the anime is really, really well done. Welcome to our Hikaru no Go fan podcast.
We'll do that one right after the stationary podcast.
It's go time is what
we're calling. Oh, there we go. Yes. Yes.
Perfect.
Yeah. So many spin-off podcasts from this one episode.
Yeah, someone needs to send this episode to iHeartRadio so they can hire us to do like 20 different podcasts.
Yes.
They've got some weird stuff on there.
Yeah, I enjoy some of the iHeartRadio, but then when I hear the promos, I'm like, wait, what? You guys also do? Oh, that doesn't sound good at all.
Spaghetti at the Wall podcast.
Welcome to our new podcast that's about other podcasts.
Yes. All right.
Anyways, okay, so Takeshi Obata had done Hikaru no Go, and then he'd also done Cyborg G-chan in the 80s. So he's, I believe, the older of the two creators, but we don't know for sure because Tsugumi Oba is a pen name, and there's some mystery surrounding his actual identity, which is interesting.
Do they only do meetings with him through a laptop that has the letter O on the screen?
I'm going to say yes.
Okay.
In fact, that's not that crazy an idea, because in the author bio in my copy of Death Note, Tsugumi Oba does describe himself in ways that are very similar to L, like in the way that he sits and his appreciation of teacups.
I did notice that, yeah.
Tsugumi Oba had done like a short comic in Shonen Jump before Death Note, but Death Note was kind of his breakout work. So he teamed up with Takeshi Obata to do this book, and it was a huge success. And then they've done Death Note ran from 2003 to 2006. Collected together, it makes up 12 volumes of manga. I think there was also a sequel, which I haven't read. And then they went on to do Bakuman together. And then they are, I believe, currently working on one called Platinum End, which I don't know anything about.
I have fond memories of Bakuman, so it was really interesting to go back and see the work that preceded it. And I actually had pulled up Bakuman on my screen here to remind myself of the artwork. And I definitely think that, yeah, Takeshi Obata, I think, improves with each subsequent work. I mean, like, the work in Death Note's good, but I think that, like, you can see the growth in the art. So it's kind of interesting to sort of go backwards.
Yeah, it's fun. It's exciting when we get to delve into a lot of different series by the same creator. So maybe we'll go back and do kind of a go.
Ooh, there
punish,
we go.
Punish John.
Yes. I'm down for it. We gotta change.
I can't remember the last time I said no to one of our book choices, so if you want to pick it.
You just have to use our new podcast name for that episode, that's all.
Okay, so what are your thoughts about Death Note? This was my choice, but I want to know your experiences.
Well, I will go first, as I have very strong memories of this work. And so we were chatting that it came out in 2003, and I probably read it right at launch, like very, very close to launch. Like it came out with a little bit of a splash, and it was a little bit of a cultural moment, I will say, especially in the manga community. There in the cosplay world, there were tons of people dressed up as Ellen Light, and it was a good time to be a manga fan. But what's interesting to me is, as I was rereading it, it's one of those books that was so foundational when it came out that now it feels kind of cliched and tropey. So it's kind of like Scott Pilgrim in that sense, because like the idea of the Death Note was so cool and interesting at the time that a lot of people found it really, really compelling. And I think foundationally, the premise is still really strong, which is why I think, John, you know, you're more in touch with the youth. You mentioned that it's getting a little bit of a resurgence right now, probably because the anime is on Netflix.
Yeah.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know how widespread this was. This was just in the class I taught this year. Suddenly Death Note was the new big thing. So like everyone was talking about it. There was some drama where one student was writing another student's name in their Death Note.
It doesn't surprise
me. I mean, if you know
me.
The story, you know what the context of that is.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me that this idea is still compelling, because it is such a strong and juicy premise. Mm-hmm. But as I was reading it, my reaction is like, this is very high school morality. Right? You know, like the whole concept of like, is it okay to kill if they're bad? You know, like it's a very kind of surface level, you know, moral philosophical question. And so we can talk more about that, but that was my initial reaction. So I had a lot of fun rereading it. I still think it's a very strong work, and I'd love to talk more about it.
Yeah, I'm gonna echo you on the like high school morality end of it. Like it's funny because I've been retreading a lot of old media from my youth, and like stuff that just seemed to make so much sense when I was 28. Now that I'm 40, I'm like, it's really not that simple. Like there's a lot more nuance here. Like you can't just kill people because you think they're bad. Like, who are you to decide that people deserve to die, you know? But yeah, so this is, I actually kind of wish that this book delved into that question maybe a little bit more, because I will agree. I think that the premise was like pretty solid, like reading, especially the first volume where they're just setting up, like there's this book that you can write people's name in and they die, and this teenager gets it and he's killing bad people. And eventually the police realize that someone is murdering criminals, and so then they're investigating, and then he starts killing the investigators, and it's like, and that's where you're like, Light just lost me at that point. But then they introduce like L as this, like, I don't know, Sherlock Holmes, who this reclusive Sherlock Holmes. And so it sort of becomes this game of cat and mouse between Light and L. And that I found really compelling, which we talked about this before we recorded, but like that's, I read ahead and I read like volumes 3 and 4, because like the big thing for me was, when are these guys going to encounter each other? Like, how long can they keep sort of like not seeing each other and not interacting while they're like hunting for each other? And that I found really compelling. But I think like the, and again, this is, I think, a byproduct of being much older, but I think the big thing that just drove me crazy in this book is that like Light is what, 17 years old?
Something like that. Yeah. I think that's not right. Yeah.
And it's like there's multiple instances in the story where he walks up to like grown ass adults and it's just like, I have a good idea and you should listen to me. And these adults are like, oh, yes, sure. And I'm just like, no adult will ever have a teenager talk to them and be like, oh, that's a good idea, teenager. I'm going to go with what you say. Like, I think the last chapter of book two, I threw the book across the room when, like, was it Naomi?
Oh, the FBI agent, right?
The FBI agent, Naomi Missouri, who's supposed to be this, like, super talented FBI agent. And, like, she just, like, she gets killed. Spoilers, she gets killed because Light is just like, hey, you should trust me. My dad is in the investigation. And she's like, well, 17-year-old boy, sounds good. Let me divulge all my secrets. Like,
yeah, and there's like the scene that she's like, she spells out her name, because in order to actually kill someone with the death note, you have to write their name right. You can't spell it wrong.
Yeah.
So she explains like how to write her name the right way, which is like that's a thing people do. Like if you want to know how to spell someone's name, that's how you do it. You tell what the characters are. But it's also not something you would generally do, I think, if you're introducing someone for the first time that you don't want to write your name in a death note to kill you.
Yeah. Just like the levels to which Light is embraced and trusted by everyone around him is just too much for me. Like it just feels too, like it's too kind of like wish fulfillment, male power fantasy of just like, well, when I was a teenager, I thought I was super smart. So let's make a character that's a super smart teenager and everyone just like has total faith in their intelligence and ability and like does not question them in any way. Like,
yeah, it definitely is a little bit frustrating rereading it with a bit more of a mature lens. But I will say that your comment on L being a Sherlock Holmes character to me is spot on. And I think one of the really interesting subversions that keeps Death Note kind of relevant and still interesting to read is because it's kind of like Sherlock Holmes from the perspective of Moriarty, which it's surprising that that isn't done more often or in other ways, considering that, you know, Sherlock Holmes as a mythos is so huge and like especially recently has been redone like 4 different ways, but never with that particular twist. So I think that alone is interesting to examine.
And correct me if I'm wrong, because I didn't actually finish reading the manga, but I did finish watching the anime at one point. Isn't L like descended from Sherlock Holmes or something like that?
I didn't finish it either, to be honest with you.
Okay.
So I don't remember.
I think that does come up later on. Like, that's kind of a spoiler, but it doesn't really affect the story, so whatever.
What is it with anime and, like, oh, you're descendant of this and that? Like, everything's grounded about bloodlines. Come on.
I know. It's true.
I am sorry. I'm pissed off because it just came up in Naruto as well. And I'm like, everything. I'm so bored. Uh-huh. So bored of this.
Isn't that a thing
bullshit
in Dragon Ball Z too, where he's descendant of the Monkey King or something?
Yeah, well, he's a descendant of like the king of what is it, like Vegetable Planet, whatever they call it.
Oh, okay.
Not Namek.
Yeah, it's always bloodlines. You gotta keep those monarchies going.
Right. I mean, I would say that I think especially in what I know of Japanese culture, that idea of lineage and like inheritance from your ancestor, I think makes a lot of sense. Like, I think that their culture looks back at ancestry a lot, and like their emperor bloodline is very, very constrained compared to the British royal family. So like, I think that is kind of a cultural thing in Japan as well.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. It makes sense. It makes sense. But like, because it's so big in Japanese culture, it's, it's so heavy in the, in the narratives. And it's like, as a reader, I do like to see other twists sometimes.
Right. Yeah.
Well, let's go over the plot really quick here.
Yeah.
Because you both brought up some threads that I want to pick up on, but just to remind people who haven't read this recently, what happens in the first two volumes. So teenager Light Yagami finds a death note by accident, I'm putting quotation marks around that, that has been left in the human world by Ryuk, who is a Shinigami, which is kind of like a death god. And with this note, he now has the power to kill anyone he wants by writing their name in the book. And he decides immediately to use this to get rid of quote unquote bad people, to improve society, because human society is garbage and only he can make it better. He immediately starts doing this. He's like super smart and very clever. So he's like making all these precautions that seem totally unnecessary at first. But sure enough, the police figure out what he's up to and they start investigating, and they happen to be very dedicated and clever as well. So there, it's like a cat and mouse game. He is using the death note while simultaneously like studying for final exams so that he can get into the best college. And eventually we are gradually introduced to the character of L, who is a mysterious figure that no one ever meets, that we only see at first from behind a computer monitor, who is helping out the police with their investigation. And L is a brilliant detective, basically Sherlock Holmes, and narrows down who has this power. The internet names the person who's killing people Kira, and Light kind of adopts that name for himself because that's the name that people know him by now. And so L is convinced that Kira lives in Japan and specifically in the Tokyo region, and they go back and forth, and the Interpol sends in the FBI to investigate because they don't trust the Japanese police. So there needs to be like a separate body who's keeping an eye on the police to make sure that they don't have a connection to Kira. But then like 12 FBI agents, the 12 FBI agents who have been working undercover in Japan all die, and the cat and mouse game continues.
And I think one of the most satisfying twists early on is that you find out Light is the son of the chief of police.
Yeah.
Which that I thought was a very satisfying revelation. Yeah.
And eventually we meet L, or the police meet L in person. He is a very strange teenager, also a teenager, apparently.
Teens rule the world.
Yeah. And he's sort of a counterpoint to Light in that they have a lot in common, but they have a very different demeanor. L is very strange. He sits in a weird way. He has strange mannerisms. He looks weird. He dresses like a slob. He never wears shoes. And
he only eats cake. I think that comes up a little later, but you realize that he only eats cake.
Seems like it. Can't remember if we get to that in book two yet or not.
I don't think so.
And yeah, they're sort of like, then they become the Sherlock Holmes and the Moriarty of this story.
I think it's good that we didn't see L in book one. I thought like coming to it again, like, oh, it's like, it sets up this like really big kind of expectation about L. Although I'm glad we didn't have to wait much longer than book two to finally see him. So I thought the balance there of like how long we held back on who L is and then when it was revealed, I thought that was very, very artfully handled and very satisfying as a reader.
Yeah.
I like L's look. I like that he is such a compelling character, especially as after you've spent so long with Kira or Light and been like, oh yeah, this child prodigy who's like 100% got his shit together, and he's like very prim and proper, like the person who's challenging him must also be very together, right? And apparently not, but not that he's not together, but he's like he has different priorities, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, and I think the mystery of L throughout volume one was great. And then when he shows up in volume two, I agree. I really like that. And actually, I just shout out to Takeshi Obata for some really good body acting. Like, just all of the, like chewing on his thumbnail and, like, you poking at things with his toes. Like, the way L moves his body, you can just feel the awkwardness.
Yeah, and his facial expressions too. He's got weird facial expressions. Like, yeah. I don't think Light ever does. Light only ever has his sort of like poker face throughout the entire series. But no, like L is the one who's like putting his emotions on his face.
Yeah.
And like, I thought the character design in general in Death Note is very strong. And that's like another reason probably why it's so enduring, because like the characters still do look very compelling and very iconic just from like a first glance. Especially Ryuk and the other Shinigami. They are a different sort of Shinigami. Like, I think there are some aspects to them that look very ghoulish and unique, despite still relying on a lot of standard imagery, like the heavy blacks and the big bat-like wings and skull motifs and things like that. So it manages to feel like both classic and fresh. And some of the ways that Ryuk's expressions are drawn are still like very unsettling and strange.
Oh, yeah.
And I really enjoy that work, that art.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, he can just stare at Light from like hovering behind him. And just that, even that blank expression is like, this is really like unsettling.
Yeah.
His eyes are kind of like not focused.
Yeah, it's the big wall eyes, like these giant golf ball wall eyes that are like just like
strange teeth. Like,
yeah, I actually kind of wonder if the rendition of It in the recent movie is like maybe they got that from Ryuk, because he does the same thing with his eyes.
Interesting. Potentially.
I don't know.
I can't watch horror movies, so I can't comment.
I haven't watched that yet. But the Shinigami stuff is like when they go to the Shinigami world as well, just like the way everything's just a little bit off and unsettling, and each Shinigami is very like unique. That was really good stuff. Yeah. I really liked the setup of just like there are these Shinigami and they have these magic notebooks and this one Shinigami's bored. So he just gives it to a teenager to just see what would happen. And what happens is really entertaining for Ryuk, you know?
Yeah. The boredom aspect is really fun. I think it makes Ryuk a very neutral and interesting character, right? Because he's not necessarily on Light's side. The way that he divulges information is very strategic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think he's being fully honest. He says to Light that he picked him at random, but he also at one point says that he chose two people to receive death notes. So I don't think it was random that he just happened to like deposit this death note at the feet of the top ranking student in Japan.
Yeah. Ryuk has some cards that he's keeping close to the chest for sure. Which makes him and this kind of like passive observing delight is kind of a fun aspect where he's like, oh, you did something I didn't expect. But
yeah. having Ryuk as Light's like hype man throughout the first chapter is like pretty good. I mean, it's like when I started reading this, I was sort of like, wow, like what a crazy premise. Like, where do you go with this? And I will say, like, it continued to surprise me with like where the twists and turns were. But I also, again, it's like it took me a while to sort of adjust to this idea that like in this world, there is a person named L who no one's ever seen, no one's ever heard their voice, and the police trust them implicitly. And if this random person behind a computer screen requests police reports and police resources, this person gets them without question because they are L. And that is just the way this world works.
Yeah, international reputation. No,
yeah.
International. But, like, it is, like, it's a similar kind of beat to the, as we mentioned, the Sherlock Holmes mythos, right? Because right, Sherlock right. Holmes, as a character, as a myth, has the same kind of
right
dubious clout.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. He doesn't work for the police.
No, right. he doesn't. And the police are just like, trust him. They're like, oh, this is another one for Sherlock Holmes, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. No, and it's interesting because I did think about, because again, when I made that connection in my head about, you know, L is Sherlock Holmes, but then I was like, oh, but if this was an actual Sherlock Holmes adventure, Sherlock Holmes would drop dead in like the first chapter because he's so famous that Light would be like, well, better get rid of this guy right away. And so like, it's very convenient that like L has the clout of Sherlock Holmes, but has chosen to remain so anonymous that there's no face and no name that can like connect back to him for him to be killed by the Death Note.
It is convenient. However, I feel like there's enough in it to make it somewhat plausible. For example, like the fact that he's 17, like he knows, you know, despite Light's easy time of like moving through the world as a 17-year-old, at least L is smart enough to realize that it's like, hey, if they clung on to the fact that I'm 17, they're probably not going to give me all these like high-profile international cases anymore.
That's a good point.
And also, like, he likes to live his life in a way with like unconventional mannerisms and habits, and knows enough to know that it also would reduce his clout. Whereas Sherlock Holmes himself, the original character, is known to be like extremely proper and extremely charming. So like has that ability to smooth things over and create that buy-in, despite a bit of a brusque personality, perhaps. But
right.
And it's interesting that like L, I feel, lacks that brusque personality.
Yeah.
I think L is a lot warmer and more polite to the people around him,
right.
Which makes him a lot more likable in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but he's also like, your first impression of him on meeting him would be the opposite of Sherlock Holmes, where like, what's with this weird kid who doesn't wear shoes?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so if he knows enough about himself, then like his reluctance to give his identity makes sense. Because he wants, his goal is to be able to continue to solve these fun cases. And so being public would prevent that.
Yeah. I mean like, and I mean, I will say like, again, my skepticism at the sort of initial concept of L aside, like I did buy into this cat and mouse game. And when L gets revealed, I was delightfully surprised by the fact that he wasn't what I was expecting. Though, again, I had another moment of like, okay, so all these grown ass adults are just going to be like, okay, 17-year-old, you know more than we do. Like,
it's very fun having you here, Jeff, as a new reader, and your perspective. Because, I originally read this when I was about 7.
And I think that's part of its appeal.
It was 19. Yeah, I was about 19 when I read it.
So I have a couple of context things that I want to bring in to sort of see what you think about them, because I have a theory that maybe there's more depth to this story than there seems. I agree that, like, on a surface level, it's just this sort of, like, very sort of teenage outlook on the world where you have the power to kill people, so of course you're going to use it on criminals without really examining it. I feel like there's maybe another level below that, but I want to give you some context to sort of support that before I make my case.
Right.
So I basically read the entire Wikipedia entry on the death penalty in Japan.
Interesting. Okay.
So they do have the death penalty in Japan. Yeah. It is not used very often. Wikipedia, for some reason, has a list of the executions that they've done over the last few years, which is okay, Wikipedia. But the point is that there's like less than a dozen executions per year. And it's only used in cases, or only generally used in cases, where there have been multiple homicides by the same perpetrator. So they wouldn't tend to use it. And of course, it depends on individual judges. So it's not like a hard and fast rule, but it tends not to be used even for like a very violent crime if it's one person who's killed. But if someone has killed multiple people, whether it was premeditated or not, then those are the people who end up on death row. There is like surveys of the general population in Japan say that most people in Japan support the death penalty as it stands. There's not a lot of opposition to it, but there is some. Between 1989 and 1993, there were no executions. After it was revealed that some previous executions had been unjust, and so the government just like who the Minister of Justice has to sign off on executions, and just no Minister of Justice was willing to do that for a while. Because there's kind of this idea in Japan that the court system is infallible. And the idea that the courts would make a mistake and kill the wrong person was like unsettling. And like politically, no one was willing to carry out executions for a while. That changed in the 90s. There were a series of high profile violent crimes. I'm not going to be able to remember them all, but one of them was the sarin gas attack on the subway. Mm-hmm. And so things like that, I think, gave people the perception that there was a rise in violent crime, at least. Whether or not the statistics bear that out or not, I don't know. But after that, like, support for the death penalty is back. Also interesting is that it is generally expected that criminals who have been convicted of murder will confess, either as part of the trial process or afterwards. And that is part of the process of execution, that you have to have the person confess, and which obviously, I'm sure in some cases, leads to forced confessions. And there was a group of MPs in the government that was against the death penalty, but the one member of that group that ended up in power, like as the justice minister, didn't follow through with their philosophy once in power. So there is some pushback against this idea, but it's not enough to actually change the law. So my theory about what Death Note is about is that this is sort of a commentary on either the death penalty or fascism, where Light is kind of this like fascist ideal. He's sort of like this perfect student. He looks perfect. He acts perfect. He does everything he's supposed to. He follows all the roles he has in society. He studies for every test. And he has like bought into this sort of fascist idea that the world is a mess and people are terrible. And the only way to fix it is to execute all the troublemakers.
Yeah, to exert control, right? And yeah. Like authority, authoritarianism. Mm-hmm.
And that the police are trying to stop him, but they... even with the help of Light, they're not very good at it.
And also, like, there is a little bit of doubt even among the police, where it's like, oh, well, he is getting rid of some of these people that we've been, you know, unable to pin down through the legal system for a really long time.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, like, the police are either, a lot of them are too afraid to take him on. A lot of them like his ideas, like, not only the main police characters, but enough of them that, like, this is sort of in the background. And so they're kind of unable to defeat him in the same way that police are generally bad at stopping fascism.
It's an interesting take. And the thing on the death penalty is also, I think, very interesting context, because as we mentioned a little bit earlier with lineages, this is very much a product of Japanese culture. And that context is really important to take into account. Do we have the death penalty in Canada anymore?
We don't.
No. No.
But in the States, we do. And yeah. I think there's been a lot of, you know, back and forth and discussion about death penalty in the U.S. and a lot of,
But then in the U.S. is also sort of
executions
a,
recently.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And then in the U.S. is also the racial element of it, too, where,
yeah,
like, Black people are disproportionately in prison in the first place. So I think this would be a very different story if it was, if say you were Netflix and adapted it to take place in the United States.
Oh, yeah, I know. You'd be really, you'd be a total idiot if you set it in Seattle or something. That wouldn't make any sense at all.
I did not watch that adaptation for obvious reasons. So I can't comment on it. But like, I think this is very valid. There is a live action adaptation from Japan, though.
Oh.
I have heard about it. I haven't seen it.
I think I've seen clips. I don't think I've watched the whole thing through.
I didn't watch the, so to be fair, I didn't watch the Netflix movie. Was it a movie or a show? Anyways, I didn't watch the Netflix thing because I was like, well, I'm not going to watch this until I've read the original. And then everyone was talking about how it was just not really doing justice to the original source material. And now upon reading the manga, like, I feel very validated in never having watched the Netflix adaptation, because it just seems like being in Tokyo and having like this sort of, I don't, even though like I don't think Shinigami are necessarily part of like Shintoism, just like there's a sort of Japanese-ness to the whole story that just, if you set it somewhere else, it just doesn't work anymore. Like, it kind of has to be centered in Japan for the story to work, in my opinion.
Let's put it this way. I don't disagree. I think this iteration of the story is very Japanese. I think if you were to transplant it to another culture, you'd have to do way, way, way more work.
Right.
To like really
think yes, yeah,
deeply.
Yeah.
For example, as John brought up, like the context, the cultural context, you can't just change the names. It's like trying to transplant Akira without doing the work. Which again, like, no one would do. That'd be crazy.
Imagine if you cast Scarlett Johansson as a robot.
The Ghost of the Shell. Like,
yeah.
We're getting off topic.
This is our next podcast. Please don't adapt that.
Please don't adapt
that. So yeah, I mean, some of this I knew already. What I found interesting is how few executions there are in Japan, and how, like, I'm not sure how much that informs the story writing, but Light is killing a lot more people than is normal. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and I think the cultural reaction as it's portrayed to that is also very interesting. And so I think the statistics that you brought up with that the death penalty is perceived positively by the population is also very interesting. And so, like, for Kira to manifest and develop fan clubs, it's like, at first it's like, finally someone's cleaning up the riffraff, and then they start to get scared, right, of like, if I screw up, Kira is gonna come get me. And that's interesting.
Yeah, there's one point where someone comments to Light about how crime, like violent crime, is way down, and it's actually Light who points out, like, totally out of character, I guess he's just trying to cover his tracks, that, well, violent crime is only down if you don't include the people that Kira is killing.
Interesting.
Right. I've forgotten that. But yeah.
Ew.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is like a smaller sample, but like, when I was living in Japan, I did have a conversation with a Japanese resident, like a native Japanese person, about the death penalty in Japan, and their take was that it's just sort of this thing that nobody wants to talk about, that, like, nobody really wants to think about it or investigate it. It's just like, well, the government's taking care of murderers, and it's good that we take care of murderers, but, like, any kind of, like, deeper conversation about, like, what that says about the society as a whole, or, like, looking at, like, what if we make a mistake or the wrong, like, it's just kind of, yeah, this idea that, like, it needs to be an infallible system, and so we're not going to think about it or investigate it in any way, because if we pull on these threads, we might be uncomfortable with what we find. So there, my Japanese friend's take was, like, it's sort of this blind spot that, like, nobody really wants to think about it or address it or talk about it, because then you might have to have a bunch of uncomfortable thoughts in your head, so best to just, like, not pretend it's not even happening. Like, it doesn't actually get reported, right? Like, if they execute someone, that doesn't get news coverage in Japan.
Hmm.
So, and like, that's how I think how the conversation started, because they were saying, oh, they hung that whatever guy yesterday. And I was like, oh, I didn't hear about that. And he's like, no, you wouldn't. They don't talk about it in the news because it's unpleasant and nobody wants to think about it. Like, yeah, it's kind of this blind spot in the culture there.
Yeah, so in his estimation. In that context, it is very interesting that this story puts it very front and center and very in your face. And like, when you think about the quote unquote high school morality, like in countries where the death penalty still exists, it really does come down to that. Mm-hmm. Is it okay to kill someone if they're bad? You know, like, so it is still a question that we do have to think about and answer.
Yeah.
So that is very interesting. Very sobering.
I will say, like, I mean, I made a note to myself about this too, which is, I mean, as much as I think I'm currently in a headspace where, you know, I've really been examining, like, the role of police in our society and just, like, how culturally we're all kind of, or certain groups of people are trained to just, like, you default to, I call the police. Oh, there's a thing that's making me uncomfortable. I call the police. And I'm really sort of becoming more skeptical of this idea that you need to call the police in all these different instances, and that things are a lot more complicated. And so, you know, I completely disagree with Light Yagami's premise, but again, because he's 17, I'm like, oh yeah, if I was 17 year old Jeff would be like, yeah, Light Yagami makes some good points. Like,
yeah. And I kind of wish that Death Note like delved more into those sort of ideas. It doesn't, it never does. But, to really sort of think about like the consequences on the world of what's happening, where will people not call the police to arrest criminals if they know that there's a pretty good chance that Kira will execute that criminal?
Right.
Like, we never asked that question in the book.
They also, one thing that I think I was thinking about just now is like, often in Death Note, they're sort of saying like criminals were killed, and you're like, okay, but what did they do? Like, what are the crimes? Like, did they just like steal something? Because like, I'm not on board with that. But like, if they did mass murder, like, we can have a conversation about that, you know? Like,
yeah, they're described as like mob people, right? Mm-hmm. Which like, yeah, the Yakuza and the mob and delinquency. Like, I'm watching another show, like low-key shout out to Tokyo Revengers, but that's another kind of examination, sort of, I don't know how realistic it is, about like this like delinquent like teen mob kind of subculture that has existed, may continue to exist to a certain degree in Japan. So it's like, yeah, he was arrested for being like a known mobster, but what does that really mean? How was he raised? Like, what was the context of how he was trying to survive? And the people that Light chooses to execute are invariably men, which is another really interesting kind of like footnote. I don't know.
Yeah. I noticed that. You're right.
Yeah. So I noticed that I had been using the male gender, and it's like, oh yeah, that is another kind of weird thing. But despite the simplicity of this examination and the fact that it doesn't go disappointing that it doesn't go perhaps deep enough from our perspective, I'm really glad that it exists. I'm really glad that it was written in 2003, because what I've noticed as I've started to broaden my depth of reading manga and also reading comics and other works through the generations, you see these ideas, especially in things that are as popular as Death Note, kind of get reflected upon. And so like, we could look at this through the lens of shoujo. So for example, there is the Sailor Moon phenomena, right? And the magical girl trope, which is then finally starting to get re-examined. So like, Cardcaptor Sakura does some interesting stuff with it a little later on. And then we get Madoka Magica, where they're really trying to examine like the role of, you know, gender and like this female power kind of thing, and what it means to like sacrifice yourself to this like metaphysical being to protect the world, you know? And so I'm curious, like I said, we haven't seen a lot of these like Moriarty perspectives. Are we going to get more of that? Are we going to get a Death Note reflection either from the West or the East? Because as we've mentioned, like, this is something that it hit a lot of people in my generation, And now it's getting, the concepts are getting a bit of a resurgence with Netflix picking up the anime.
I mean, yeah, I definitely would say, like, you seem to know more, John, because you've read more than me, but, like, I read more of this, and, like, I was hoping for more investigation within this work, but, yeah, if it inspires other people to start investigating, I think that would be fantastic, because, I mean, I do think that maybe that, to me, is the compelling thing about this book, is that question it poses of, like, if you have the power to kill someone, should you, or like, you know, does that actually make the world a better place? It's like, you know, like you were joking about at the beginning, like what names would you put in the book? And like, you know, joking, I thought about that myself, and I have a list.
From Twitter, be careful.
but then I thought to myself, I was like, but would it really, like, wouldn't this just create a vacuum that's going to be filled in by more of the same kinds of people? Like,
You have like the Batman and Joker thing, right? You know, like superheroes are the ones who create supervillains, right?
I think that, like, if you're quote unquote creating a better world by murdering a whole bunch of people, like, you've already failed. Like, you've, step one, you've already, like, it's not a better world now because you've had to kill all these people to make it happen. Like,
yeah, it's interesting. It's like go back to zero.
All right, we are running out of time. Good news, we have a whole second episode, which we'll do at some point on the next two volumes. You can talk more about Light and L, because they haven't met yet so far. But they will.
Yeah, I think I'll wait till we record those episodes, but I have thoughts on how female characters are written in this series too.
Yes.
I'm not looking forward to revisiting those ones, but I am glad we will read more. I'm down for it.
I want to just quickly shout out L's super ancient Mac G4 that he uses while sitting on the floor.
I used to have one of those.
As soon as they did the first shot of L sitting on the ground with a computer on the ground with him, I was like, this guy lives in Japan, because that is like a very Japanese thing. It's just like, I don't need a chair or a desk. I'm just going to use this computer on the floor.
Love it.
Okay. Do we have shout outs?
I do. So I'd like to shout out Band Book Club, which is co-written by Ryan Estrada and Kim Hyun-suk and illustrated by Ko Nyum-ju. I had this book on my radar for a while, and I finally, it was nominated for an Eisner recently, which is fantastic. I finally sat down and read it, and I think it's a really powerful work, and I was, I had high expectations going in, and they were surpassed. So I strongly recommend this book. Really interesting. Also, a short shout out for a short story called Look Back, which recently released, and it's by the creator of the Chainsaw Man manga. So it's a 104-page side story, which is free to read if you look it up. And it's about kind of the nature of being a comic creator and the nature of the impact that you and your work can have on other people. So those are my two shout outs for today.
All right. Well, if we're doing two shout outs, I just want I'm Jeff Ellis, and I'm going to shout out vaccines first. vaccines are great. I highly recommend. You should get two. They really open up the world for you. And I also wanted to actually recommend a book.
What?
So, yeah, I was going to shout out Conflict Is Not Abuse by Sarah Schulman. And it's just a really kind of deep meditation on interpersonal conflict, starting with conflict between two people and kind of working its way up to nation to nation conflict. And the sort of manifesto is to investigate your own sort of feelings and work towards trying to negotiate peace with other people rather than default to shunning and consequences in all cases, like trying to sort of repair bridges rather than burn bridges. Really, really good read. I'm actually on my second pass through on the audiobook right now.
Well,
if we're going to do two, I've got two. So first, I don't think we've shouted this out before, but I apologize if we have. I'm going to shout out the ACCast, which is a podcast about Kathy, the comic strip. It's so good. Like, she goes into the history of the comic strip. There's actually like an overreaching arc to the strips that I had no idea about when I would happen across it in the newspaper, and sort of the historical context of it and the comics that came before, the comics that came during. And it, she interviews Kathy, like the creator. It's really good.
If this interests you, I did a bit of a deep dive on Kathy a few years ago. There is a really good retrospective at VPL, which does have like a lot of these strips.
Okay.
Hey.
And the other thing I want to shout out is also a book, Axiom's End by Lindsay Ellis. It's so much better than I thought it was going to be. It's a kind of a science fiction story about aliens. I'm not going to tell you what it's secretly a fanfic of, because it's better to just experience it. It's so much better than just being a fanfic. It's like, I was delinquent on getting all my Death Note read for this podcast because I've just been listening to this book nonstop.
Excited. I have some new things on my list. Thank you. Oh, by the way, I'm Jam. I don't think I ever mentioned.
Jam, what is our next book?
Next, we are going to read The Magic Fish by Chunlei Nguyen.
Okay. The Trade Waiters is presented by Cloudscape Comics. We'd like to thank Sleuth for the music. You can find us on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Podcasts. Thanks for listening.